This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking with Lee Melhado, the executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation today, about Jewish burial traditions. Lee, welcome.
Thank you.
So what's interesting about Jewish burial traditions?
Well, I think two things. One of them is that they're different from sort of the culture at large. Mm-hmm. And the other is that they're very personalized. They're very the bodies are prepared for burial by individuals in the community, not by the funeral home itself.
Not by professionals, sort
right.
of.
Huh. Right.
Friends, family members?
They're not supposed to be directly related. There are certain categories, mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, and spouse, and also probably in-laws, would not actually prepare the body, but anyone else in the community could do that.
Hmm. And tell me a little bit about the history of this. Why is this done?
It's done out of respect for the dead and out of respect for the living, both. And the practices are quite ancient. Some of them are described in the Bible. And by as early as the Middle Ages, Jewish burial societies had evolved. And they're called Chevra Kedisha, and they still have that name today.
And these burial societies, so it's made up of people who are acquainted with the person who's died, or not necessarily?
Well, the burial societies are all volunteer.
Okay.
And it's considered a great honor to be a member of a burial society, and it's done anonymously so that the people who are receiving the benefits from it don't know exactly who was on the team that prepared the body or who was among the people who stayed with the body from death until burial. Because it's something that you do, it's the truest form of good deed that you can possibly do because the person is deceased and they can't thank you. You're doing it out of love for and respect for them, not in order to get a thank you.
Yeah. Or to get anything in return.
To get anything at all,
right.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, people have such odd attitudes towards death. In this culture, we tend to avoid it. We tend not to talk about it. And yet we're often fascinated by it. Tell us what happens. A person in the Jewish community dies. And is this always done? Or is this a choice?
This is a choice. It's the traditional choice, but it's nevertheless a choice. And we certainly would not want to force any particular practice or ritual on anyone. The Burial Society in Champaign-Urbana started about 15 years ago when Hadassah, which is an organization that existed here for 65 years, it's now we don't have an active chapter anymore, but they had a study session. And there were several families at the time who had an interest in burial practices and death and mourning practices generally because they had elderly people in their family or, in one case, there was someone who had a stillborn child. And so this study group formed and studied for a year or two various writings on death and mourning traditions and burial traditions. And they put together a very nice document, about a 20-page brochure, which has twice been distributed in the Jewish community, to let people know what choices are available. Judaism is no more monolithic than Christianity is. There's lots of different branches of Judaism and lots of different attitudes and lots of different practices. And so the effort of this booklet was to try to explain what the choices are rather than to convince people to do a particular thing.
Okay. Now, if a family, well, let me back up a little bit. Does the person in a Jewish community who knows they're going to die eventually say, this is what I'd like, or is it totally left up to the family, or?
A little of both.
Okay.
I have had actually people who were in the hospital or in hospice call me and say, I'd like to make an appointment with you. I want to talk with you about what I'd like when I when I'm gone, what I want you to do. I usually encourage them not to just have the conversation with me, but also to have their family involved, because once they're dead, it's the family that will be making the decisions.
Of course.
And the idea is to get them on the same page so that they're not arguments or questions at the time. Because the practice in Judaism is to bury as quickly as possible, preferably within 24 hours. And many of the burials do occur within 24 hours. You are allowed to delay a burial if people who are mourners are coming from far away. Mm. So it does occur that someone might not be buried for a day and a half or 2 days or even occasionally three, and that's all right. But usually there's not a lot of time, and so questions need to be answered before the death, if possible.
With people's families scattered out all over the country and all over the world these days, is it more typical that people wait more than 24 hours, or do most of the Jewish burials where people are observant and following these traditions happen within 24 hours?
Usually pretty close, 24, 36, I would say we can do it a lot of the time. But if people have mourners from far away, we're not going to say that they can't come. I mean, that's wrong. They need to be there too.
So tell us what actually happens.
Okay. We would get a call possibly from the rabbi, possibly from the cemetery committee, possibly from the family itself, saying that they've decided that they'd like the Chevra Kedisha to be involved. And generally, they want me to review with them what are the possibilities. And I tell them, well, you can it's kind of like a menu. Mm-hmm. You can have the body prepared, washed, and put in shrouds and put in a classic traditional casket. And that's one thing. You can have people who stay with the body from the moment of death until the time of burial. Mm. That's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can do both of those things, or you can choose to do neither.
Mm-hmm.
Now, generally, if they're calling me, they want to do one or the other or both.
Okay. Now, is there a funeral home, a funeral director involved at all in this?
Well, in the state of Illinois, you're supposed to prepare bodies for burial in official funeral homes. So we do the preparation in funeral homes, and there are several in town.
So there's a law about that, a state law?
That's what they tell me. I haven't personally investigated that, but that's what I'm told, and that's
all
what
right.
we do.
Okay.
There are five in town that I've been in, three that we use fairly frequently.
Hmm. Now, ordinarily when someone dies, there's a coroner involved or not?
That's usually outside our purview. Generally, the vast majority of people die in a hospital or in a hospice. A few die at home or in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we get the call, the individual is deceased and the legal aspects of it are generally taken care of.
Okay.
Very few exceptions.
All right.
But in any case, we would not be able to do anything with the body until the body were legally released.
And so what about transporting a body? There are laws about that too, right? Does that have to be done by a licensed funeral director?
That's done by the funeral director.
Okay.
And we have started, depending on the circumstances, we have started sometimes with the shomers, the people who watch the body, in the hospital or in the nursing home if transport has to be delayed for some reason.
Now, what's the idea of watching a body?
Well, it's to keep the body company in a humane psychological sense.
Hmm.
In a theological sense, it's to watch over the soul, which is in classical Judaism thought of as hovering around the body for a while. It doesn't leave instantly.
Hmm.
And I think also in probably a respect for the dead sense, you don't want anything disrespectful or harmful to happen to the body of your loved one.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is with the body continuously from death to burial, then the body is not vulnerable to anything that might be disrespectful or untoward.
Okay. And does part of that concern come from the fact that Jews have been a minority in this country and also almost everywhere? for so many centuries, that there may be worries about abuse to a body by people who aren't Jews?
Possibly, especially in terms of ancient times troubled times, mm-hmm. Socially troubled times. I think in America today, the thought process is more about others don't know what Jewish burial practices are what Jewish death and mourning practices are.
Uh-huh. What's appropriate?
For example, a body is not embalmed. Well, if the body is just taken from the hospital to the funeral home and the funeral home isn't instructed that this is a Jewish burial and that embalming should not occur, often that's one of the first things that's done. So if you have somebody with the body, then that person can say this is a Jewish burial.
Sure.
And the body shouldn't be embalmed.
I want to follow up on that, but let me give the phone numbers for listeners who may want to ask a question themselves or make a comment. This is a live program every Sunday afternoon on WILL from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time. And people in Champaign-Urbana, where our studio is, may call 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Listeners, if it would be a long-distance call, may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. So listeners away from Champaign-Urbana, even on the Internet, may use 1-800-222-WILL. My guest today on Keeping the Faith is Lee Melhado, who, in addition to being executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation, has also been serving as the acting chair of the Jewish Burial Society. And we're talking with her today about various Jewish customs. Why not embalming?
Well, blood is considered to be the source of life in Judaism, and that's why, for example, in Kashrut, the laws having to do with food, that animals that are slaughtered, the meat is prepared in such a way that it doesn't contain blood. You're not supposed to eat blood, and that injunction occurs over and over again in the Bible, that you're forbidden from eating blood.
Hmm.
So in a human being, the blood is considered the source of life. It's part of the body, and it's a particularly sacred part of the body. And so to discard it is to throw away something that is holy. We're made in God's image, and the blood is the source of the life, and shouldn't be thrown away as though it was just waste.
Interesting. In embalming, blood is taken out of a body and replaced with various fluids that sort of, in a sense, preserve the body at least for a while, right?
That's the thought.
Right. Now, for Christians who are thinking about, for example, the customs of burial in the New Testament for Jesus and the disciples and so on, who were all Jews, do we know anything about what the Jewish burial customs were and traditions of first century Judaism?
Well, I think they were very similar to what we do now.
Huh.
Immediate burial,
uh-huh.
No embalming.
Okay.
The body is washed and dressed in shrouds.
Huh.
And the grave is covered immediately after the burial. I mean, even today, many of the burials end with the everyone who was there shoveling the earth in the grave until it's entirely full.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Now, the biggest difference that I see as I'm hearing this for the first time between sort of traditional American burial customs and these Jewish burial customs you're describing is it's hands-on.
It's very hands-on. It's very real.
It's you don't have the remove that so many have become accustomed to where after a person dies, they're just gone. You know, you never even see the body. There may be embalming and, you know, makeup and all that sort of stuff put on this dead body to make it look like it's alive. But you really never see a dead body. And this, at least some people are focusing on this dead body, staying with it, caring for it, washing it, wrapping it, and then putting the dirt over it when it's in a grave. What's the emotional or psychological payoff of that?
Well, I think part of it is, you mean for the people who are living or for the mourners?
Yeah, for the people who are doing it, who are volunteering to do this for their fellows.
Part of it is that you know that friends and community members are taking care of the person that you know. It's not strangers.
Okay.
Part of it is that you know because you're doing it that it's being done in a respectful way.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that when someone dies, everyone wants to be helpful. Everyone wants to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, don't really know
what to do. Yeah.
And this is something extremely intimate and extremely tender and very helpful.
Hmm. Why is the body washed?
So that it will be in a state of ritual purity. It's not a physical washing in the sense of removing dirt. The bodies are almost always very clean when they come to us, but it's a ritual washing, and it's because the body is going to be with God, and it should be in the most pure state possible. So it's a ritual washing rather than a physical washing.
Hmm. So is the body nude?
Between the time, you get the body and it's usually in a hospital gown.
Mm-hmm.
So after the body is identified, usually with the bracelet, then you do remove the clothing. But the body's covered at all times with a sheet, and you only remove what part of it is necessary to do the ritual washing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pour water over it. Generally at that point it is nude, except the sexual organs may be covered with a towel.
Mm-hmm.
And then the body is immediately dried thoroughly and, again, kept covered while it's being dried. We use several sheets and towels. And then as soon as it's dry, you put the clothing on, the shrouds.
Shroud. Yeah. I want to ask about the shroud, but before we do that, how many people are involved in this? Are there rules about that, or must there always be, for example, two there? Or?
You could, in theory, do it with one, and I think that the Jewish community in Danville, which is very small, often does it with only one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's helpful to have, I would say, 4 to 5, because a dead body doesn't cooperate with you, and you have to move it around in order to be able to dress it. So we usually try to use 4 or 5. You can lift the body into the coffin with a mechanical lift if necessary, and sometimes with some of the larger bodies, that's what we have to do. Or if we don't have enough people, if we only have 4, not 5.
Why are you looking at me as you say one of the larger bodies?
Well, now you might be a problem too. We might need a special casket because the caskets sometimes aren't quite as big as they need to be.
For listeners who've never seen me, I happen to be 6'8" tall. So.
In your case, we would probably measure the casket before we tried to do the lift.
So what about sex? Is it the same gender who washes?
Women wash women and men wash men.
Okay.
It is possible if you don't have enough men to do it, it is possible to have a woman's team prepare a man, but you cannot have a man's team prepare a woman.
Interesting. Okay. Now, you've actually done this yourself.
Yes.
When was the first time you did it?
10 or 15 years ago, probably close to 15 years ago.
And can you remember your own motivation? Did someone suggest you do this, ask you to do it? Were you just wanting to be helpful?
Well, I think I was interested because I knew the people who were in the Torah study group, the Hadassah study group, and I had talked to many of them as they were writing the booklet and talking about the whole issue. And it struck me as something I'd be interested in. Initially, I just signed up to be one of the watchers, one of the shomers. I wasn't really keen on actually seeing or handling the dead body. When you're a shomer, the body's covered with a sheet if it hasn't been prepared for death, or it's in a casket if it's already been prepared for death. And
an
you're
open
waiting for
casket
the
or a closed casket?
No, it's always a closed casket.
Always closed.
Always closed.
Okay.
So you don't, if you're being a shomer, you don't see the body. And that was really initially all I was up for.
Mm-hmm.
After I'd done that a number of times, someone called me because they needed an additional person to fill out the Tahara team, the ritual washing. And I said, okay. I was a little hesitant. I didn't know if it would freak me out. But it was easy. The people who were on the team, usually we try to have only one new person on a team at a time,
okay,
so we can teach them how.
Mm.
And the people on the team had done it several times before, and they were very well organized. And it's a very cohesive, warm feeling as you're working together to do this.
Now, are there ever young people who volunteer to do this, or are most of the volunteers or all of them of l'âge certain, a certain age?
Well, in theory, anyone over the age of 13, anyone who had already achieved Bar or Bat Mitzvah age could do it. In practice, I think the youngest people that have done it are probably in their 30s.
Hmm.
So we've had anyone from 30 to 70. Eventually, people get to be of an age where they say, you know, I don't have the strength to do this anymore.
Sure.
But there's some people who are physically fit who are in their mid-late 70s who are still helping.
Hmm. How many people in the local Jewish community in Champaign-Urbana area are volunteer to do this?
I think on the men's list for doing the purification and dressing, I think we have about 10 men. I think we have 15 or 16 women. And then I think we have a total of about 50 or 60 who will agree to be shomers,
okay,
watchers.
And how often are you called upon to do this?
Well, that's kind of the sad part. It's become more common frequently. I would recently, because our community is aging, and about one-third of the people in our list of membership is over the age of 65.
I see.
So in the last year, well, since October, we've done 7 burials. And
so in a typical year these days?
Typical year, I would say 7 or 8. 10 years ago, it was more like 2 or 3.
Mm. Are you depressed before, after, never?
Never. It's always...
But it seems so morbid. Why?
Oh, it doesn't feel morbid at all. Mm. The families are usually quite distressed.
Mm-hmm.
They're depending upon you. They want knowledgeable assistance, guidance, and they want a clear explanation of what their choices are.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know that their loved one is with somebody that they can trust. And they usually express incredible gratitude. We generally have to be, or I generally have to be in contact with the family multiple times in order to get the Hebrew name, in order to return items to the family after the person has been buried. I usually go to the funeral and to the burial, to the meal at the house afterwards. I generally participate in Shiva afterwards. Most of the time I know the family well to start with. The few times that I haven't known the family well to start with, I know them well by the time it's done. It doesn't seem in the least depressing. It seems like a really wonderful thing to be doing for people who need your help. And I feel tremendously drained each time, but I really feel good about it.
We're talking with Lee Malhado, who is the acting chair of the Jewish Burial Society in Champaign-Urbana, about Jewish burial traditions. And this is a live program, and we encourage listeners to give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. 1-800-222-9455. We do have a caller waiting on line 1. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
I was unclear. Does a body in the state of Illinois have to be embalmed or not?
No, it does not have to be.
But if it's not embalmed, there does have to be a burial within a certain amount of time, right? I believe it's maybe 48 hours, but it's...
I don't think that I don't think if the body isn't embalmed that it has to be buried within 48 hours. There
really?
Is a rule on transportation.
Ah.
If a body isn't embalmed, then it can't be transported after a certain period.
I see.
And that period might be 40. It's either 24 or 48 hours.
Okay.
Will a funeral home deal with somebody who doesn't care to be involved or embalmed or not? Because I've heard they even want to. I'm Christian, but whether you even if you're going to be burned,
cremated,
you have to be involved. Thank you.
Right.
Cremated, that you have to be involved.
It's not required. But my father, for example, when he died a couple years ago, I happen to be Christian too. He chose not, his preference was that he be buried quickly, within 24 hours, and he didn't choose to be embalmed, and that was fine.
So, I got one more question, if you have time.
Of course, go right ahead.
It's not specifically, I guess, about burial, but is there any non-religious reason to get all the blood out of an animal before you eat it? Is there a, you know, there's a lot of things, I think, anyway, in the Bible that have something to do from a practical health direction, maybe dealing with the times more than perhaps, you know, anything else. And I was just wondering about that, if there's something about removing the blood that generally lends itself to better health.
I don't think so. The reason for that rule is very clear in the Bible. There's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's not clear, and there are a lot of rules about about eating and about rules for eating that are not clear. But this particular one is very clear. There are several places, I don't know, maybe five or six places where it says you shall not eat the blood because it is the source of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And a lot of people certainly seem to be very healthy after eating fairly raw steaks.
Well, and other people, not Jews, but I mean, there's blood pudding. There's all kinds of other people who eat, who do eat blood, and in a cooked form. And I don't think there are ill health effects from it.
Now, Lee, you happen to be trained as a scientist as well as a theologian, an expert on Jewish tradition. Can you get all the blood out of meat before you eat it?
You probably can't get 100%, but kashrut gets a lot of it out.
Okay.
And I guess the worst part of it is steak, that which is an example that I can think of where you can really tell. I'll tell you what I mean in a second. The animal is killed in such a way that it bleeds profusely at the time of death for the reason not only of getting all the blood out, but also to be merciful to the animal. You want the animal to lose consciousness immediately, to die quickly. And then after the animal is cut up into pieces, those are soaked in salt. And then once they're soaked in salt for quite a while, it has to be 24 hours. Then you take it and you soak it in water and you change the water repeatedly. You have to change the water at least three times. So by the time you're done preparing this meat to make it kosher, it's had all the juice, all the blood sucked out of it. And most things like roasts and things that you cook in a damp method or covered, the quality of the meat, you know, just tastes really good. But if you're doing something like steak where the juices drip off, you can – if you cook steak anything more than medium, it tastes like a piece of leather.
I see. Okay. So some of the flavor has been lost in that process.
You really do get a lot. I don't know what percentage of it is, but you get a lot of the blood out.
We have another caller waiting to talk with our guest, Lee Malhado. You're on the air.
Line one?
Yes.
Hi. This doesn't relate directly to burial, but you mentioned Hebrew name. Does everybody have a Hebrew name, and can modern names be transliterated into Hebrew?
That's two questions. The first, does everyone, every Jew, have a Hebrew name? And the answer to that is no. A great many of them do. The name is usually given to them for a male at the time of the bris, when he's circumcised, and for a female at a welcoming of the baby in the synagogue on the first Sabbath after the baby is born, and the girl baby is named there. So most babies, Jewish babies, do receive a Jewish name, but some do not. And some people got one, but they don't remember what it was, and their parents aren't around, and so they don't know what it is. And in those circumstances, people can get their own names, and sometimes synagogues will have ceremonies where they have names for adults. I know Sinai Temple did several years ago, and mm-hmm. quite a number of people who did not have Jewish names chose to get their mm-hmm. names then. Can you transliterate them into Hebrew? You can take a lot of names and do that. It doesn't work for all names. Some quote-unquote Hebrew names are not actually Hebrew names. They're Yiddish names because the Ashkenazi Eastern European Jews lived with Yiddish as their language for so many years that the practice came to give them names which were Yiddish. And so some people have names that are a mixture of Yiddish and Hebrew, and some people have names that are just Yiddish.
Now, Lee, you're a convert to Judaism, so I want to ask you about if you have a Hebrew name and how you got it, how it was chosen. But let me, since we're about halfway through our program, I'll let you think about that. While I remind listeners, this is Keeping the Faith here on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communication here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And, of course, it is listener-supported, as are all of our programs. And we do want to thank listeners to this program as well as others who have responded so positively to our requests for financial contributions to WILL. We still don't know exactly what's going to happen with the budget for next year. We'll be learning that soon, but thanks to all who've made contributions to help continue this program and the others that are available on WILL. My wife and I are happy to be donors to WILL and encourage others to do the same if you haven't. Only about 10% of people who listen to WILL actually make contributions, so we're encouraging others to step up and help make these kind of programs possible. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Coming up next week, we'll be continuing our sort of minor series of two programs that are dealing with death and dying issues. We're talking about Jewish burial traditions this week. Next week, we'll be talking with representatives from the Pravina Covenant Hospice, which is a special program for people who are facing their last days. We'll be talking with the director, Ruth Matawick, and others from Pravina Covenant Hospice. On July 17, our guest will be Elihu Smith talking about Buddhist practices in a diverse cultural setting. Elihu Smith is the leader of the Prairie Zen Center. On July 24, our guest will be playing an archive program from last March. We've had many requests for a repeat of that program with Bruce Falk, who's a professor of geology at the university and also active in the Department of Microbiology. We'll be talking about evolution and faith. So we'll be having a scientist who is also a person of faith talking about why he thinks it makes perfect sense to believe in God and also evolution. And on July 31, to cover the last day in our next month, or rather this month, Pastor Roger Diggs from Grace Lutheran Church will be our guest, and we'll be talking on the subject of, and this is an interesting one, God and the ivory-billed woodpecker. God and the ivory-billed woodpecker. So those are some of the programs coming up ahead here on Keeping the Faith. This program is supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest student organization continually active at the U of I. We're now in our 132nd year on this campus. I haven't been here quite the whole 132 years, but I've been director of the Y the last six, and I've been active there in support of programs like Friday Forum and Know Your University for a couple decades, and we'll be telling you more about those programs. It'll be starting up in the fall. Some people have asked about our program called Dump and Run, where we accept items that might be useful to students who are coming here in the fall, items of furniture and so on. At this time, we're not accepting general donations of clothes and kitchen items and all those things. We're only accepting furniture. And the reason for that is we can put the furniture directly on the semi-trailer truck that we have sitting by the Y, but we have to sort through all the other things and box them in categories, and we simply don't have room at the Y during the month of July to do that because of our community programs that are taking up all of our various rooms. So if you have furniture, yes, you can bring it. It's better to call so we know when it's coming, Monday through Friday, please, between 8:30 and 4. Well, let's get back to our phones and our topic. Our guest again, Lee Malhado from the Jewish Federation, talking about Jewish burial traditions. Let's go to line number one. You're on the air. Line
Hi.
One. Yes.
I have two questions. One is, what's the Jewish attitude about cremation? And the other is this a free service, or is there a donation that's requested of the family for sending to the deceased?
Thank you.
Regarding cremation, I won't say that it's never done. My own father-in-law was cremated because he adamantly insisted that he be cremated, and my husband spent 10 years prior to his death agonizing with his father about this. But in the end, he felt he had to respect his father, and he did it. But cremation is not classically approved as a Jewish burial practice, strongly disapproved, and that has been added to the feeling about cremation among many Jews has been added to by the Holocaust, because the image of having Jewish people cremated was so horrendous during that period that it adds an additional flavor to the traditional rejection of cremation.
And why was it traditionally rejected?
Because the body is supposed to be preserved. It's a holy thing. It's not ours to burn up.
But it comes apart automatically eventually anyway.
But that is in keeping with the biblical phrase of from dust to dust.
I see.
Through a natural process.
I see.
Now, if a body is inadvertently cremated by accident or in a fire, mm-hmm. or through some kind of war, mm-hmm. act, the person would be considered to be, you know, they would still receive the normal Jewish rites. But mm-hmm. As a conscious choice, most Jews will not choose cremation. But I must say that there are those who do.
Sure.
And including many in this community. And I don't want to imply that I look down on them or anything. That's their personal
choice.
That's
sure.
their personal choice.
And what about his second question? Does it cost anything to have these services?
The service is actually free. There is no fee. We do ask that if people would make a donation, we gratefully accept it, because there are expenses associated with this. There's not only the shrouds themselves, but also other materials that are needed. And besides burying people who are members of our community, we also, or who are financially capable, we also bury the indigent. And generally they're Jewish, mm-hmm. but occasionally they're not. And so we try to build up enough of a fund from the donations mm-hmm. that we get that we are able to bury indigents when we need to. And
so sometimes you even have to pay for a cemetery plot.
For the cemetery plot, for the casket. For the funeral homes do not give us their services entirely for free. I mean, the families are still paying the funeral home. So if
they can afford it.
Right. If we wind up doing about one indigent burial a year, and we've done a couple that have not been within the Jewish community.
We have several callers waiting. Let's go to line two. You're on Keeping the Faith with Lee Malhado.
Hello. I've got two questions. Does classical Judaism believe in an afterlife? And my second question is, would you talk about mourning, you know, after the funeral, the grieving process within Judaism?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
I'll just hang up.
That's fine.
The belief in the afterlife is part of classical Judaism in the sense that upon dying, the soul and the body are seen as separating, and the soul returning to God, which it does over the space of approximately a year. The afterlife is not conceived of as a physical place. It's a state of being, and it's not a uniform place. There are places that are closer to God and places that are farther away from God. There is no concept of hell in the sense that I think Christians tend to think of it. There is a place called Gehenna, but that basically is just the absence of God. It's not a place with fire and brimstone and the devil and that kind of thing. So that's sort of the classical Jewish conception. Do all Jews believe in this? Very definitely not. I think that a lot of Jews don't know whether there's an afterlife or not, and many of them would say that there isn't. So there's a huge difference of opinion from person to person about that.
And the question of mourning. What happens with sitting Shiva, for example?
Well, mourning in Judaism, before I answer that question, I always want to say something that you touched on earlier that I don't want to forget because I think it's really important. You asked me a little while ago about what's good about doing this and what's good about having a Chevra Kedisha and what's good about how I feel afterwards and how the other people feel. One of the other things that I didn't mention earlier is central, and that is the way the community pulls together. That Sinai Temple sells the cemetery plots. They own the cemetery plots. Sinai Temple provides the condolence committee that gives the meal of condolence after the burial is completed. Jewish Federation provides information about death and mourning practices, and we run the Chevra Kedisha. The cemetery, which is not a Jewish cemetery, and the funeral homes, which are not Jewish funeral homes, everyone comes together and works very collaboratively and respectfully. And the feeling that I have and that the team has every time we do this is just we all wish that everything in life could work this collaboratively. The cooperation that we get is fantastic. And when I call people to be shomers, to be watchers, or I call people to be on the Tahara team, usually when you're calling people to get volunteers, if you're lucky to get one volunteer for every four or five people you call. When I call when there's a death and I need someone for a team or shomer, I would say 99% of people say yes.
Take time off from work, whatever it
takes. Whatever it takes.
I want to save our talk about mourning because we do have a caller who's been waiting very patiently on line
three. Okay, and then we'll get to the other lady's question about mourning.
I promise to get back to that. But let's go to line three now. Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm on the air. Thank you for the program. I had a son who died suddenly, and I have had a very big and still have that a very big trouble with that he had to take an autopsy. And I don't know.
Like me to speak about autopsy and the need for autopsy when it's permitted and not?
It had to be done because of the
circumstances
or whatever, yes. The regulation. But I felt horrible about it and still feel very bad about that it had to happen.
Sure.
Well, the I don't know if it'll help you or not, but the official Jewish position on autopsy is that it shouldn't be done except, but there are several exceptions in which case it is recommended. One is if the cause of death is not clear and that by doing an autopsy that someone else may benefit from the knowledge that is acquired, then an autopsy is not only permitted, it's recommended.
Encouraged.
Mm-hmm. An autopsy, of course, is required in legal circumstances if there has been a crime of some kind.
Or even a suspicion.
Mm-hmm. And again, Judaism always bows to the legal authority of the land. And so the appropriate Jewish thing to do is, of course, you do what is legally required. Mm. So I don't know what exactly your son's circumstances were, but if his autopsy was done for a legal reason or for a health reason to try to resolve any uncertainty about why he died. Mm-hmm. In both cases, that is entirely compatible with Jewish tradition.
You mentioned earlier the issue of a stillbirth. My wife and I, sadly, between the birth of our two children who lived, had a stillbirth. And in that case, it was recommended that we have an autopsy because it wasn't clear at all why this child had died in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out they couldn't discover even after the autopsy the reason for it. But it seemed worth doing at that time, even though that was a horrible thing to contemplate.
Right. And the way the autopsy is usually done, too, in these circumstances is the body is generally all of the organs are put back in place and mm-hmm. the body is sewn back together mm-hmm. So that, that the parts are all there, which Jewishly is what's required.
Mm-hmm.
And if a tissue sample has to be taken in mm-hmm. order to do pathology on it, that's permissible.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the question of mourning. And you mentioned the word sitting Shiva.
Shiva, yes.
Shiva.
The mourning process in Judaism is it's timed to fit with psychological unfolding of the grief process.
Mm-hmm.
And the period, it's divided into periods. The first period is from the time of death until the time of burial. And during that period, the mourners are absolved of all kinds of responsibilities. Their only need is to help prepare for the burial, and any other official responsibilities, work or religious responsibilities or anything else, they're set aside. That lasts until the body is buried. The next stage is from the time of burial until the end of 7 days, and that's the period you mentioned, Shiva. Shiva means seven. And during that period, people generally stay at home. They wouldn't go to their business. And they might observe other practices, some of them quite ancient. They wouldn't bathe for pleasure, although they could bathe in order to get clean. They wouldn't wear leather shoes.
Hmm.
They wouldn't out of respect for animals. Again,
oh, I see.
They wouldn't engage in marital relations. They wouldn't cut their hair. They wouldn't shave if they were male. They wouldn't cut their fingernails. All of these things have to do with your personal appearance. When someone close to you has died, you're not worried about how you look.
I see.
You're occupied with other things.
Oh.
The first 3 days of Shiva are seen and have for many years been seen as more intense than the last 4 days. So there's a tradition in some parts of the community only to observe 3 days of Shiva, and that's quite well recognized in the Reform community, for example. So after Shiva is over, there's another period, the Shloshim, which means 30, and that's from the first 30 days after the burial. And during that period, people are gradually moving back into life. They go to work again. But they wouldn't still shave or get their hair cut. They wouldn't go to a musical concert. They wouldn't go to joyous celebrations, things like that. Then there's another period that is the first 12 months after burial.
Now, is that true even for the Sabbath?
No. On Sabbath and the festival days and at weddings and certain other things, certain joyous occasions where the entire community celebrates, then you set aside your public mourning. There are certain private practices that, like the cutting the fingernails or the shaving or the hair cutting, that you might maintain. But not eating meat and wine, for example, on Shabbos, you would eat meat and wine. On the Sabbath, you would go to synagogue. You wouldn't stay in your home.
Okay.
So there's this difference between the public days of celebration, and it does influence the degree of mourning. And then for parents, one continues to mourn for a year. And at the end of the year is something called a Yahrzeit, which means a year time. Basically, it's an anniversary. That's a Yiddish or a German term. And one says certain prayers and lights candles on the Yahrzeit for the remainder of your life. Hmm. So my mother died 40-some years ago, and I still light a Yahrzeit candle for her on her Yahrzeit.
We have another caller waiting on line one. I'll get to that in just a second, but let me just give the numbers again since we're down to our last 6 or 7 minutes. We can accept another call or two. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana area. If it's a long-distance call, use our 800 line, 222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL if you're outside the Champaign-Urbana listing area. Line one, you're on the air.
Yes. Would you comment on the prevalence of organ donation?
On the prevalence or the permissibility?
Well, permissibility. You know, the option is an option for many, many people. And it sounds to me as though it would not be an option for many of your faith.
I appreciate this call a lot because that is a very common misperception. And there might even be certain segments of extremely observant Jews who would hold that organ donation was not permissible. But the vast majority of Jews, including most Orthodox, recognize that organ donation provides the opportunity for extension of life to another individual. And therefore, the principle of life overrides everything else, just as it overrides the Sabbath practices. Mm-hmm. It overrides the other restrictions on death and mourning and burial. So if another human being can maintain life by taking one of your organs after you've died, yes, organ donation is allowed.
Is it even encouraged?
I think it would be encouraged by some and not by others.
Okay. Right.
But it is certainly allowed by the vast majority. Okay. I mean, I'm talking more than 95%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, never got back to it, about your being a convert to Judaism.
Right.
And I was wondering about Hebrew names. You have one?
Yes, I do.
Is it public?
Well, I'll let you know what it is. It isn't a secret. It's I actually have... Well, I'll explain. The Hebrew name contains your own Hebrew name, like a given name, and mine is Rut, which is Ruth. And I chose that because Ruth was a convert.
Mm-hmm.
The other option would have been Leah, because my name is Lee. Mm-hmm. But I like the story of Ruth very, very much. Mm-hmm. And I was really in love with my husband, and I liked the idea of I will go where you will go and mm-hmm. follow you for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I like that very much. Mm-hmm. And... The other thing is that the end of your name is most traditionally, your father's name. But you know, if you're ill or in Sephardic communities, if related to burial practices, you use the mother's name. And now more and more in the Reform and conservative communities, people are using both the mother's and the father's name. Now, a convert doesn't want to masquerade as a non-convert.
Hmm.
So there is a requirement that the convert have as a last name, daughter of Abraham or daughter, if you use both male and female, daughter of Abraham and Sarah.
Hmm.
So my name is officially Ruth Bat Avraham Vesara. However, I do have two people who were really important to me. One was a Jewish woman and one was an Episcopalian priest. And I informally use their names because they are my spiritual mother and father. So I'm Rut Bat Raphael Vetzipura.
Hmm. Hmm. Now tell us about the Episcopal priest. That seems a bit unusual.
When I was in my teen years and at college, there was a priest. I think he's still living. His name was Ralph Brooks, and he was a very wonderful man and really understood younger people, and I developed a very close relationship to him. And he was really nurturing, and it was a hard time for me. My mother was dying, and she died my first year in college, and he helped me get through a very, very difficult period. And I just revere him for that, and so...
And so even after you converted to Judaism, you carried that at least informally as a tribute.
Right.
Hmm. Right. Well, it shows again the importance of campus ministry.
Very definitely. He would love to hear you say that.
We're talking with Lee Malhado about Jewish burial traditions, and I want to thank all the callers we've had. Lee, I and our callers may not have known enough to ask all the questions. On my list, I still have a question about what is a shroud?
Okay. I'm glad you asked. I didn't know what a shroud was until I saw them. A shroud comes in a set, and the men's and women's are slightly different, but they're mostly the same. They're made of linen or cotton. The ones we use are cotton muslin. And they're white. They're very crudely sewn together in the sense that they don't look like really finished garments. They're sturdy, but they're not beautiful. Hmm. They're just plain white garments. And they include a pair of pants that has no openings for the feet because you're not going to be walking anywhere.
Hmm.
And that has a tie around the waist, a shirt which just pulls over the head and has no collar but has a tie at the neck, and it goes down about mid-thigh. Then there's a kittle, like a robe that looks just like the shirt except it has a collar and it also has a tie around the waist. Mm. And then the men have a head covering that just goes over the whole head, kind of like a bag. It's called a mitznefet.
Hmm.
And then the women have a bonnet and a face covering, which is just a square of white cloth. And some of the shrouds for women have an apron, but many of them do not. They're slight variations, and they're just local custom about where the one that you bought was made. They're not legislated. They don't have to be exactly the same, but that's basically what they are. They're usually pretty roomy garments because you got to be able to put someone in who can't help you get in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wrap them in what's called a sovev. It's like a large sheet, and after you've put them in all of those other things, then you wrap them in the sheet and just they're all in a little tight bundle in the casket.
Hmm.
Usually you lift them onto the sheet, the sovev, and then close them up in it.
And in terms of a casket, we only have 10 seconds. Why a cheap pine box instead of a lovely, expensive casket?
Everyone is the same in death, and you can't take it with you.
Our guest today has been Lee Malhado, who is the executive director of the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation and the acting chair of the Jewish Burial Society for Champaign-Urbana. She said I could give an email address if people have further questions, and that's cujf@shalomcu.org. cujf@shalomcu.org if you have other questions. I want to thank Lee and our callers. Next week, we'll be talking about death and dying and hospice. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Do you ever have a right to kill? What about Israeli agents who assassinate Hamas leaders or suicide bombers who blow up their enemies? William Volman has written a 3,000-page treatise on the morality of violence. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk with William Volman about living in a violent world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s and south winds up to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the upper 80s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low in the upper 60s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.